2FM with Green Farm. Healthy snacking made easy with Green Farm's high protein on the go range. Available in selected Tesco, Super Value and convenience stores nationwide.
It's Wednesday the 25th of November and you're listening to Game On.
Coming up tonight, Jonathan Wilson and Alan Cawley talk about the football legacy of the great Diego Maradona.
Huddle. Enrique to Maradona. Different class. Different class! When they talked about the great players of World Championship football, this man will be on a pedestal.
Absolutely, very sad day indeed. We'll also have nutritionist Orla Walsh to talk to Dunica about hunger management.
Really, I know that, what's new?
My favourite song.
That's got Andrew written all over it. Okay. With both Camogie semi-finals this weekend, Aoife Murray will predict who'll make it to the final.
Here comes Galway with the ball. Shot goes in and the ball is brilliantly blocked and finished to the net. Scored by Ailish O'Reilly for Galway.
Nadine Doherty will analyse the ladies' football semi-final showdown between Dublin and Armagh.
Carly Rogue has thrust away a shoot, try and chance again. McCaffrey!
Game on 2FM.
Now, everyone, do text us on 50155. Please do or tweet at Game On 2FM. We'd love to hear from you. I think a lot of people will be sitting at home now looking up YouTube clips of Diego Maradona, because I think it's fair to say he was one of the greatest footballers of all time. He very sadly passed away only age 60. He was absolutely worshipped for his genius on the pitch, but off it, I think his demons almost destroyed him, if not destroyed him. He had a very colourful life, but I think he's one of those rare people that whatever happened off the pitch, it will not take away from what he did on the pitch. His talent was just so unbelievable. He made so many memories for people, and I'm delighted to say that Alan Cawley is with us in studio, and we're going to talk to Jonathan Wilson, journalist with The Guardian and The Blizzard, very, very shortly. Alan, I'm going to go to you first, just as a football fan, to say goodbye really to somebody that would have shaped so many memories and made people, so many people fall in love with football.
Yeah, normally, Marie, when I suppose when I come in here, first of all, I'm bubbly and upbeat and we're talking about football and whatever the case may be, but I'm genuinely upset tonight. I really am. I'm absolutely devastated. And normally when, I suppose, iconic figures like pop stars or film stars like that, when they come to their end of life and they might be in their 80s or 90s or whatever the age that they are, and sadly to pass away, I never quite understand when people get upset about it. But I can understand it tonight, and for the first time ever, because as you say, we're just fans or admirers of these people, so we have no obviously close connection towards them. But with Maradona, it's like everybody, especially my generation and especially football people or football fans, had that connection. And for all the reasons that you outlined, obviously first and foremost for the football and what he brought to it, and how many people would have fallen in love for that, but also with the off the field issues and antics and all that, and no matter what he kind of did or didn't do, you always had to find somewhere good in it or find a soft spot and have be sympathetic towards it. But it was only last year really when that documentary was made, an unbelievable documentary that I went to see, and Channel 4 have played it out since, and funny enough I only watched it last week. It's only then that you get some sort of understanding of the chaotic lifestyle and what was going on in that man's life. And I came away thinking, obviously, we have Messi and Ronaldo now, and the debate breaks out all the time, I suppose, for the current generation. And a lot of people go along with Messi, and I suppose the stick that's always thrown at him is that he never won a World Cup. And then you go back to maybe Maradona's time, and before that there's George Best and Pele, and those debates that break out. But I walked away after seeing the documentary saying there is absolutely no debate, because of the chaos that was going on in that man's life, because of the era that he played in terms of the Italian football and the beatings he used to take on a pitch and come back, because of the standard of the pitch also, and because of what he achieved at Napoli, that when he signed for Napoli they were literally seen as the peasants of Italy, both socially and economically, and he revitalised the whole city almost on his own single-handedly, and winning Serie A and going on to win it again in 1990 and won the UEFA Cup as well, an Italian Cup. An unbelievable spell that he had for those few years, which obviously all came to an end, sadly. And the quote and the line that sticks out for me even in the film was the day he signed, and the opening scene in that documentary is incredible. Olympic Stadium in Rome, 80,000 people to see him just be unveiled, and the day he left in the dark with nobody around him whatsoever, and it was so sad. But it's a very, very sad day, Marie.
I just on that, Alan, you mentioned the documentary, and it gives incredible insight to it. But you mentioned that there, the opening scene when he lands in Napoli, 80,000 people going crazy for him. He was ahead of his time in terms of nearly reaching away from the sport into nearly pop culture.
Yeah, absolutely, Dunica. Like, that scene is incredible, and I suppose the unveiling in the stadium and the crowd of people, and I'm not sure, like, people talk about George Best being the first real pop star and stuff like that. I wasn't around for that, so almost Beatle-like, but certainly with Maradona, that was the feeling, the first time that I had ever experienced anything like that. And what he went on to achieve since that, everybody always focused in on, I suppose, everything that he achieved. It was just phenomenal, really. But when you take it back to just the actual level of skill and talent that he had as well, I don't think we've ever seen anybody as naturally good. I think Messi comes as close as we'll ever see in terms of natural ability. Ronaldo, for me, is a different type of player in terms of what he's achieved physically as a specimen, and obviously technically he's very good, but it's not natural to me. Whereas I look at Messi and he's the closest we'll ever see, whereas you look at Maradona and the old clips flicking up golf balls and all sorts of whatever ball he can get his hand on and in his bare feet, and that famous warm up that does the rounds on social media and YouTube as well, Dunica, it's just incredible. And I suppose that's the joy that he brought when he was on the pitches. Well, there's another brilliant quote in the film. I actually tweeted about it earlier, but a little video of it, that it's just when he was on the pitch, life goes away and all his problems went away. And that's exactly how he played the game, though. When he was on the pitch, he was almost at peace.
Jonathan Wilson, football journalist with The Guardian and The Blizzard, joins us now. Jonathan, is it possible to sum up the impact that Maradona had on football?
Probably not. I mean, yeah, hugely talented player, but I think it's not just the talent. It's everything else that goes with it. That I think, you know, greatness isn't just an ability. You know, you look at what Maradona won, and okay, there's a World Cup which cements his reputation in Argentina, and probably means in Argentina he will always be seen as greater than Messi. There's the two Serie A titles with Napoli, but in his career he won three league titles, two domestic cups, a UEFA Cup and a World Cup, which for somebody of his ability really isn't much. And yet we, you know, commonly he's considered one of the two or three greatest players of all time, and it's because of that ability. And also it's about his story. It's about the darkness and the way he was able to transcend that darkness, and it's about how he was placed under extraordinary pressure at a time when we didn't really understand the pressure of celebrity. We didn't understand that celebrities actually do need to be protected from our own fame, and he couldn't cope with that. And you know, one of the stories that stuck with me, I wrote Angel of Dirty Faces, book on Argentinian football, and there's a huge section on Maradona, obviously. But when he moves to Barcelona for world record transfer fee, and he moves his family over to Barcelona from Boca Juniors, you know, he's been playing in Buenos Aires, which is, you know, where he's grown up, and his mother has a panic attack in Barcelona because she just can't cope. It's so different to her life in Buenos Aires. And so you think you've taken a kid, essentially, who's this incredibly gifted player, of whom there's enormous expectation, great demands being placed on him physically, emotionally, mentally, and you're suddenly sticking him in the spotlight of one of the biggest clubs in the world for the world record fee, and you're expecting him to cope with that, and of course he doesn't, and his way of coping is to turn to cocaine, which ends up destroying him.
Jonathan, you wrote a lovely piece in The Guardian today, and there was actually a lot of detail in it that I didn't know about, and you spoke about a prophecy from the 1920s, which I hadn't heard before. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so in the 1920s, there's a huge debate raging in Argentina, not just in football, but about what is it to be Argentinian? Because it's a very new country, and it's an immigrant nation that, you know, it's made up of people essentially from Europe. And they're trying to sort of, there's this ongoing conversation about who are we? And one of the things that binds them is they all support the national team who wear the blue and white stripes. And so the way that team plays becomes very central to a national self-image. And Boricotto, who was the editor of El Grafico, the great football magazine at the time, he wrote this famous piece in which he says, if we were to erect a statue to the soul of Argentinian football, it would be a pibe, an urchin kid from the streets, his teeth worn down by eating yesterday's bread, somebody from a very poor background who's, you know, can't afford fresh bread, with a shaggy mop of dark hair, so probably of indigenous heritage, as Maradona was. You know, his father was a boatman on the Paraná River. His job was ferrying cattle across to an island so they could graze. And, you know, Maradona described himself as a Capacito Negro, one of these people of mixed race who was socially disadvantaged, you know, Evita did a huge amount to try and raise their status. But, you know, he comes from a very, very difficult background. And then, you know, this description goes on and talks about wearing a shirt with holes in it, you know, he can't afford a new shirt. And if you gave somebody that description and didn't give them any context as who's that, 100% you would say Maradona. And that's 50 years before he was born, just, I think, 49 years before he was born. So Maradona arrives with a force of prophecy. It's as if he has been foretold. And so when he then leads them to the Under-20 World Cup, age, I think, 17, you know, immediately everybody is sort of, this is the guy Boricotto was talking about. This is the spirit of Argentinian football made flesh. And that, of course, only adds to all that pressure on him, all that expectation. It's talent plus sense that this is actually something a bit more than talent. This is something really special that they can't quite explain, something very integral to the soul of a nation.
It's absolutely amazing. And as well, there's a story in it that he went for a trial when he was 8 years old and nobody believed that he was 8 years old. They needed identification from a kid because he was so good, Jonathan.
Well, he was so good and he was so small. You know, it wasn't just his talent. It was that, you know, he came, you know, he grew up in Bishop Fiorito, which is, you know, a shanty town on the southeastern edge of Buenos Aires. You know, places were so violent that the police had to bust in every day. They couldn't maintain a police station because it was too dangerous. He was malnourished. And I think this is actually very significant to his development, that they began giving him supplements and injections. And so he got very used to, you know, to taking, you know, in that case, legal drugs. But, you know, the idea that you could get chemical support became part of his makeup. And, of course, by the early 90s, that becomes hugely significant, and it leads to his ban from after the 94 or during the 94 World Cup.
Just on that, Alan, more than talent, and you spoke about it there, the treatment he took on the pitch, and with his background and what Jonathan has outlined there, it's very clear that, you know, he was hard, he was able to take these bangs and knocks, but it must have added up.
Yeah, and it's something you associate with the South American players even nowadays as well. You look at the likes of Aguero and Tevez and these boys that we see. It definitely kind of, I suppose, it stands to them, the background that they came from, and they know exactly what it's like to grow up with nothing. But for him especially, and the one thing in the documentary as well, I suppose, that when he did get that big move, when he was leaving Boca Juniors, he bought a house for them all. That's all he wanted to do. And even his sister said towards the end that he wanted to solve everybody's problems but his own, for the family. So there's a side to him as well, I suppose. We only see the perception where obviously we see the football side and we see the chaos that was going on off it. But Maurizio Pochettino was actually a teammate of his when Maradona was coming near the end, and he was a younger player coming up playing for Argentina, and he roomed with him. And he was on Monday Night Football recently, Donegan, spoke about how humble and how amazing he was to him as a young player coming into the squad, because he was a godlike figure, as we all know, especially for a young player like Pochettino. And he spoke about how, as I say, welcoming he was towards him. There was a warmth to him, and I suppose it's what Jonathan alluded to in terms of the chaos that surrounded him and the attention. He just couldn't deal with it, whereas I think you look at the younger players now, and thankfully there's a lot more security around him, there's a lot more guidance, there's a lot more protection, which is badly needed. But for him, there was just no dealing or no feeling at all as if they could get it under control. If anything, it was getting out of hand day by day, which ultimately led to the demise, I suppose.
I guess, Jonathan, the rules just didn't apply to him, like on the field almost, you know, when you think of some of the goals that he scored, and off the field as well. He could pretty much do what he wanted to because he was revered so much.
Yeah, and I think that's something you see very early. He is indoors, and that I think cements the sense that the rules don't apply to him. And so, you know, again, you come back to the drugs issue at Napoli, when he had a fake penis made up, and he would fill the fake bladder with other people's urine, and he would squeeze that out whenever he was drug tested. And so, you know, he's giving somebody else's urine. And eventually, after the 1990 World Cup, when things start to turn against him, and there's all kinds of suggestions that the Camorra, you know, the mafia in Naples were connected with this, that suddenly the protection he'd had was removed, and he failed a drugs test, and that precipitates the decline in the early 90s. Goes back to Buenos Aires. He's on drugs charges, illegal charges there. He's not playing. He ended up joining Newell's very briefly, which was when he roomed with Pochettino. In extraordinary detail, his debut for Newell's, on the pitch at half time, they had a kid doing keepy ups to entertain the crowd, and that kid was Lionel Messi. So there's almost like a handing on of the baton at that moment. And then, he comes back for the 94 World Cup. Argentina had beaten 5-0 at home and qualified by Colombia. This great humiliation. He's in the stand, he's just watching the game while serving this drugs ban, and the crowds are chanting his name. 70,000 people in El Monumental calling for Maradona. So he gets brought back for the player, the independent player playoff against Australia, and he then commits to getting fit for the World Cup the following year, and that's when he takes the ephedrine that they end up testing positive for. So this whole sort of spiral of decline of the early 90s is prompted by the withdrawal of this protection he had, which then allowed the drug taking he'd been indulging in to come to light.
Jonathan, it's an amazing story, and already the documentaries have been made, but you have to think that there's so much appetite for everything about Maradona that the next while is going to be just flooded. I see the mayor of Napoli is to propose to name the San Paolo Stadium after him. I'm sure there'll be days and days of mourning in Argentina and a whole lot more around the world. We've been reading tributes all evening. Jonathan Wilson, thanks so much for joining us. Alan, would you mind staying with us for a little while, because we do have a lot of other football to talk about. There is a very busy night of Champions League tonight, Liverpool in action, Salah back, and no doubt will rack up that win.
You're quietly confident there.
Quietly confident. Atalanta, yeah. Good side though.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were actually going to go to a break there.
I'm going to keep you here.
Yeah, the Armoury, well, it's good that he's back. I'd say he's probably disappointed that he missed, because I always find with Salah, whereas you look at all the rest of the team, obviously Mane, Firmino, Jota has come in and done really well, and there is that team kind of ethic about them all, whereas I look at Salah and he's still the individual that all he wants to do is score goals. Even though he buys into the whole team ethic and the work rate and stuff, I still think he's the type of player that there's that selfishness when he comes off the pitch. If he hasn't scored and the team won, he's the one disappointed in the dressing room. It's a big night for the Marie. I think they can get it done tonight, like what we've seen with a lot of teams last night. So, and I'd say they're keen to do that, because if they qualify tonight with the win, they can rest players further down the line, because obviously we've had all the managers coming out in the last 3 or 4 weeks basically saying about the schedule, and rightly so as well. So if he gets the opportunity to rest a few down the line, Klopp, I'm sure he'll take advantage of that.
Man City are playing Olympiacos, and that is already underway. 24 minutes gone and it is nil all there. Good news for Dundalk today. Jordan Flores getting shortlisted for the Puskas Award. That game against Shamrock Rovers feels a very long time ago.
I know, it does feel a long time ago, Marie, and I wouldn't mind, it was some game as well. I was up in Tala that night, and it was such a brilliant game. It was only 5 games into the season. There was, I think, 7,000 people at it. We were all building up that we're going to have this amazing title race, and of course everything that's transpired since has been an absolute disaster. But for Flores, it was an unbelievable goal, absolutely incredible, and to have himself listed, it's great news for him personally, and for Dundalk as well, I suppose, just to get a little bit of recognition.
Helen, just on the goal itself, like, the award is for the most beautiful. It was incredible. Is it worthy to win it?
I don't know if it'll win it. I like Son's goal for Spurs, running the length of the pitch, basically, Dunnick. It was like something we used to do in school, and you don't really see it much. And funny enough, we're on about Maradona, and yeah, the greatest goal ever scored was by him going by players from the halfway line. But Son did something similar, not quite as good, but to do it in the modern era as well, I thought it was phenomenal. The goal against Burnley, he just took off on the edge of the box. I would say that might be the goal. But Flores, technically, the fact that he lifted his leg up so high, like almost his hip, I'm not sure how he didn't do damage to himself. But it's a brilliant goal, Dunnick. It was a brilliant match. I think it's just good for him to get a bit of personal recognition from it. I'm not sure if it'll win it.
Sligo Rovers and Derry City tonight, and whoever wins has the joy of playing Shamrock Rovers in the semi-final.
Yeah, I don't know if they want that in the semi-final, really, but it's a big game for both clubs. Obviously, Sligo had the good news towards the end, and it looks like they will get Europe, depending on who wins the cup, but it looks like they should do. But they'll want to win themselves, obviously, tonight. Derry City have had a very, very disappointing season. They finished seventh, Marie. Their away form is poor. They haven't played in actually a month, 6 weeks, because of the COVID situation as well. So you'd fancy Sligo at home. Sligo have a good record at home out of the 8 games that they won this year. The nine games that they won 6 at home. So I would fancy Sligo, and that's not me being biased. They should get by Derry tonight, but as you said, they've a massive task against Shamrock Rovers on Sunday, and we thought there might have been an upset on the cards last week when Finn Harps went 2-0 up, and when you consider the way the pitch was and the conditions and the weather and all sorts, a lesser team would have rolled over. But I think, to be fair to Shamrock Rovers, not only do they have the quality in terms of the technical ability, they showed a lot of character and resilience that night as well, Marie. They came back. People had argued they got a couple of maybe soft penalties, but they still had to come back from 2 down in a difficult place, and they did that and got themselves into the semi-final. So they're the team to beat. On the other side, you have Athlone and Dundalk in the semi-final. That's on Sunday as well. We're covering that one also. So yeah, if Sligo Rovers get through, or Derry, they'll have a difficult task in Shamrock Rovers, but they'll want to get through tonight either or.
Well, Adrian Eames is there for us.
Well, it's been a difficult year for Derry City, finishing 7th in the league, just above Finn Harps. They could make Europe, but to do so, they'll have to win the FAI Cup, and that would deprive Sligo Rovers of a European spot, Sligo having finished 4th in the league. Well, Derry's season has been disrupted by COVID outbreaks. Manager Declan Devine has stated that they've had very little preparation time for this assignment against a Sligo Rovers side who defeated them twice in the league this season. Sligo Rovers manager Liam Buckley has twice won the cup as a manager. He has acknowledged the love affair that Sligo Rovers supporters have with this famous competition, and he certainly should have his team focused on setting up a semi-final meeting against Shamrock Rovers in Tallaght on Sunday afternoon. Sligo will be without Niall Moran and Jesse Devers because of suspensions. Declan Devine, well, he guided Derry to their last FAI Cup success in 2012. Defender Ali Gilchrist is out through injury. The match kicks off at 7:30 and it's live on the Watch LOI streaming service.
Well, we are going to be talking about hunger after the break, Dunnick. I'd say you have some hangry stories.
One of my favourite topics. Yes, we're delighted to be joined by dietitian Orla Walsh. Maybe it's the dark evenings or cold weather, but is there any science behind this feeling hungry, and what can keep you feeling full for longer? So we've Orla Walsh joining us, with thanks to our super sponsors, Green Farm. And if you text or tweet us in now, you could be in with the chance to win an incredible goodie bag, which includes the entire Green Farm Rage, which is 100% natural, high in protein white meat. They have a brand new handy pack, a snack pack, which has an impressive 23 grams of protein. What about that, huh? And a handy little skewer to eat on the go. Well, mainly to keep your fingers clean. So text your hunger questions to Orla 51552 or tweet us at Game On.
Game On on 2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day the healthy way with Green Farm's on-the-go chicken bites. 100% natural and packed with protein.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. Yeah, like we said before the break, we're delighted to be joined by dietitian Orla Walsh. Orla, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Orla, we can joke about hunger and different kind of hunger management things, but could you give us the science behind it?
Well, firstly, it's a natural response to our body signals. It's perfectly normal and natural to be hungry. I guess it's just not a nice situation to be in. It's like being thirsty. It's desperate, uncomfortable. So I suppose one of my jobs as a dietitian is just to help people manage their hunger so that they feel it less often and feel it less intensely, because, you know, it is natural to be angry when we're hungry as well. So, you know, I think that people's moods can be better when they better manage their hunger.
Orla, how do you manage it?
Well, I speak directly to your wife. No, so the thing is with hunger management, I suppose there's two things that you need to remember at every single meal, every single snack, and protein and fiber will be your best friends. So protein is the macronutrient that makes us feel full and keeps us full. It's brilliant at doing that. And when they compared it against other macronutrients, it came out on top. It just takes longer to digest, I guess. I put it this way, I won't actually say the brand on air, but one of my favorite crisps, right? Now the big bag is what we're talking, right? So the big bag of crisps, my favorite ones, is equivalent in calories to around 5 to 7 chicken breasts. Now, I can eat this big bag of crisps, but I can't eat 5 to 7 chicken breasts. So you can imagine, just even your favorite examples too, that protein is one of those things that's hard to overeat. And that's because of the satiety, that feeling of fullness that it gives us. It then takes quite a long time to leave our tummy, so it keeps us fuller for longer too. And that, when you combine it with fiber, so I suppose fiber, there's two different types of fiber. There's insoluble fiber and soluble fiber. So insoluble fiber is bulky and it bulks up in our belly and it bulks up in our intestines. So it makes us feel full that way. While the soluble fiber is a gel-like fiber and it kind of goes gloopy in our stomach and gloopy in our intestines and takes ages to pass through. So that's why it makes us feel fuller for longer.
We have a lot of texts flying in, and a few of them are actually referring to intermittent fasting. And one in particular is wondering, does little and often work better than intermittent fasting?
It depends on the person, and, you know, there's such person-to-person variability. One of the interesting things is that, you know, there is a fair bit of research that says if you eat more food in the first half of the day, it can better manage your hunger as well. So I try and get people to focus on a big breakfast, you know, maybe even breakfast, lunch and dinner being three meals of equal size, but that if there was a big meal, it would be breakfast. And then snacks are dead handy. I always encourage a high protein snack mid-afternoon for people who want to manage their hunger, because the last thing you want to do is come into dinner time hungry or come into the evening time hungry, because you end up eating your meal too fast and you'll end up eating too much, and it can lead to snacking then later.
Orla, we're getting an awful lot of texts into 51552. Question for Orla. I'm in my late 50s and about 5 kgs overweight. What are the best meat/proteins to eat? And should I look to a low-carb diet?
You don't necessarily need to look to a low-carb diet. Just tailor your carbohydrate intakes to how much movement you're doing. So picture yourself as a car and how much petrol that car needs. The further you drive, the faster you drive, or the more frequently you drive your car, the more petrol you need, and our body is the exact same. As for proteins, I suppose the white proteins tend to be lower in calories than the darker colour proteins. So, and that would be white fish and white meat, such as chicken and turkey. So if you include more of them, you know, you'll probably eat less calories per bite.
Fitzy has texted in wondering, if you're trying to shed fat, does cutting out carbs really work? And then does it stay off?
Well, when it comes to body composition changes, I think the main thing is getting enough protein 3 or 4 times a day. And then it's about calorie reduction. And the research really backs the one that you can stick to most. So for some people, that's lowering their carbs. For some people, it's lowering their fat. It just depends what seems more pleasurable to you, because if you don't feel like you're doing, you know, on a diet, and if you feel like you're really enjoying your meals and it's not hardship, then you can achieve your goals.
We have a text in here, I'd say it's from a parent. What advice would you give to school kids who eat their dinner at 6 o'clock but don't eat again till their lunch break at school the following day, which could be 19 hours later?
Yeah, so it's a big long gap, and school kids probably need a supper because, well, apart from anything else, you want them to sleep well, and, you know, you don't want them to go to bed hungry. And they have so much growing to do. I think one of the mistakes we make is treating under 18s as young adults when actually, you know, they're children and adolescents. So I would bring in four meals a day, so a breakfast, lunch, dinner and supper. Do try and get a breakfast, even if it's a breakfast on the go. So if they are very short in time, something like overnight oats or a smoothie can be perfect because they can have it on the run. But I would get the breakfast in because you need to break that fast. So that's where breakfast, you know, it comes from.
Liz has texted in and she said she does eat that healthy breakfast of porridge and lunch, of porridge, and at lunch she'll have her salads or soup, and then dinner she'll have some yogurts and some nuts afterwards, but she's still feeling hungry, especially at night time.
Yeah, so the nighttime thing is common for people, and that's when people tend to snack on, you know, the less healthy stuff, the stuff that's kind of high in fats and sugars or fats and salts. So what I would encourage her to do is firstly up the protein at breakfast. So we know research kind of encourages us to have a higher protein breakfast to reduce evening snacking. Some people find that if they have a savoury breakfast, they actually snack less in the evening times. I would say that the soup and the salad, just watch and make sure you're getting enough protein. So, you know, are you getting a chicken breast or a turkey breast or a tin of tuna? Like, are you getting enough protein in the salad? And when you're having soup, if you think about it, if you're having veg soup, just saying brown bread, both healthy choices, but there's not enough protein there. And, you know, when people talk of nuts and seeds being a protein source, they do contain protein, they are a good source, but when you look at them, I'll put it this way, you know, the one tablespoon of peanut butter has a similar amount of calories as a chicken breast. So what do you get most of satiety from? It differs from person to person. So, you know, I think sometimes the choice and the protein source matters.
Orla, we've a text in from Alan in Clonakilty, and it's along the lines of the intermittent fasting, but he's wondering about eating once a day.
Oh, well, I wouldn't encourage that. And do you know, you need to remember as well with the intermittent fasting is that it doesn't suit everyone. So it doesn't suit older people because it can risk bone loss. It doesn't suit a lot of women because of hormone disturbances. So there's actually only a small subset of people that intermittent fasting suits. And when it suits, it's absolutely brilliant. And you can get results outside of just calorie restriction or outside of just, you know, healthy food changes. But it doesn't suit everyone. And, you know, I definitely wouldn't recommend one meal a day.
Once a day, Marie. He's gone over hangry at that stage if he's only having once a day.
And
you
never last.
As soon as you said Clonakilty, I was thinking, you know, there's lovely foods down there, so I don't know why he's just eating this once a day.
We have a texter who's on the way from Dublin and they're trying to eat a breast of chicken and curry chips in the car in a Bamba Plaza and wants us to stop talking because we're ruining the dinner. And that's from John on the way back to Limerick. Look, Orla, a keen runner has texted in as well, yeah. And they're doing 70 miles a week and they get bouts of feeling extremely hungry despite thinking that they are fueling properly, and this again seems to happen very late in the evening.
Yeah, and it's quite common, you know. It's like when people all of a sudden take up high intensity exercise or HIIT training and they wake up in the middle of the night and have to go for a snack, or a breastfeeding woman for that matter. We've all been that soldier. So I would encourage them to, you see, with runners, yes, you do need to make sure you're fueling with enough carbs. You know, we look at carbs in terms of body size, so grams per kilogram. You know, again, back to the car analogy, you know, what size tank is there? The more muscle you have, the more carbs you need, and, you know, that sort of thing. But I would suggest that for different sources of protein a day, and there is a fair amount of research on the impact of dairy proteins on satiety as well. So they actually might benefit from a big protein feed before bedtime. Donegal is probably aware of this as well. They use it in rugby and in a lot of sports where protecting the muscle mass or protecting the bone mass is key. And there is a big protein feed for most athletes before bed, because when we lose muscle or bone tissue, it's before bed. But also it's a case of hunger management as well, because the metabolism can be flying on all cylinders.
protein pancakes. They were my friend for many a year, Orla.
I can imagine.
We've a question in here on 51552. The keto diet, Orla. It worked well for this lady for years, but she came off it while she was pregnant. However, she knows carbs are not her friend.
Okay. So, you know, some people, the keto diet suits. I suppose for people listening, just to clarify, the keto diet is low carb, low protein, high fat. Now, there is adapted versions of the keto diet, because I'm sure a lot of people listening will be like, oh, I didn't know it was low protein, but social media will tell you myths. You know, there are adapted versions of the keto diet, which is low carb, moderate protein and high fat. And I suppose if you were going to do the keto diet, perhaps that's one, the one you might try, because it's just more sustainable, because low carb and low protein and high fat, it's trickier with regards to meals and getting the macro balance right. But as well, when it comes to the proteins, it is quite low, so there is a worry that it will result in muscle and bone loss.
From a lot of your answers there, Orla, obviously protein crops up an awful lot. Are you recommending that you should have some source of protein for every meal throughout the day, for breakfast, lunch and dinner?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where I know the world, and it's probably like, God, how come all dietitians are talking about protein all the time? And it's just because really deadly and very expensive research came out in the last 10 years. And it highlights with regards to protein that it's not just getting enough per day, but it's spreading it out across the day. Because when you eat enough protein at a mealtime, it stimulates your muscles and bone tissue to their maximum. And you want them stimulated to their maximum because they're responsible for the bulk of your metabolism. And you want them also stimulated to their maximum because you want them breaking down and rebuilding to the best of their ability. And really, and now this is where research is very offensive, is that, you know, really from 30 onwards, we're aging and at risk of losing muscle and bone tissue. So we have to eat protein at each meal to protect that muscle and bone as we age.
Orla, another text in here. Have you any after-school healthy snacks ideal for hungry young boys after training? We do know a good snack. Green Farm do a brilliant on-the-grow range. 23 grams of protein, and if it's not forward-selling, Orla.
Yeah, I know, and they have it in tasty flavours as well as plain, depending on whether the person's
taking. Very subtle, guys, very subtle.
Well, I think a quick sandwich, which I suppose that chicken could be used for, or turkey. But, you know, beans on toast, eggs on toast is also very quick, because you do want it a quick option, because when they come in, they want it now. And, you know, they wouldn't be at their most patient at that time. So, you know, I think a sandwich or beans or eggs on toast is a great option, or as well the old pint of milk.
Yeah, Orla, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We're going to take a quick break and we're back chatting Camogie with Aoife Murray.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. Manchester City have taken the lead against Olympiacos. Phil Foden with the goal there, and we'll be keeping an eye on that over the next few minutes. Turning our attention to Camogie, the matches are coming thick and fast, and this weekend I think we're in for a treat with two semi-finals down for a decision. And to talk us through them, we are joined by former Cork goalkeeper Aoife Murray. Aoife, let's start with Kilkenny and Cork, and in a way it's kind of hard really to discern form, because we haven't seen a huge amount of Kilkenny, and it feels like Cork are just kind of building that momentum and getting going, but realistically there's not that much time left because we're at the semi-final stage and it's happened so quickly.
I think that's the joys, isn't it, of having a quarter final if you're in the Cork camp, to have that competitive game, and to, I suppose, end with Galway in the round robin stages as well, right? That they've had those two tough games going into Saturday, whereas for Kilkenny, I suppose they've had a little bit of an easier run into the semi final, and that's no disrespect to the teams that they've come up against. And in fairness for Kilkenny, you got to beat what's in front of you. So I think it's been maybe a quieter build-up for Kilkenny, but in fairness to Brian Dowling, he's blooded a lot of new players as well, and that's a good way, I suppose, going into a semi-final. The girls will be used to the championship pace, but look, I think Saturday will be a completely different story.
I think it will be as well, and everyone is looking forward to these games. But if you were just to break it down a little bit, and if you look at the two forward units in both teams, and, you know, on paper they do look quite evenly matched just in terms of firepower, but who do you think has the edge in just in terms of those forward units?
Yeah, look, I think they are well matched. I think it should be noted, I suppose, for Kilkenny not to have Katie Power there.
would be, I suppose, a point for me, because in my opinion, I think she's been one of their most consistent performers in the big games over the last number of years. So I think that would be a significant loss for them, albeit she hasn't been there for the championship. But, you know, I suppose you have to look straight away for Kilkenny with Miriam Walsh and Denise Gall. And not just their ability as Camogie players, but also, you know, that physical presence that they bring. And then, of course, Cork, you know, look, I think Amy O'Connor, it goes without saying that she's been very busy in the championship and it's taken a lot of minding, I suppose, from oppositions. And I think the last day against Clare, you know, that opened up plenty of opportunities for Katrina Mackey, who came away with Player of the Match. And then I think you have to look at Orla Cronin, I suppose, pulling the strings at centre forward. I think she came away with 6 points possibly the last day. So, you know, look, I think they're quite evenly matched, but they're different with regard to physique and the way the style of play. So it'll be really interesting to see how both defences set up.
Yeah, and the matchups then are quite interesting as well. And you kind of have to look at Anne Dalton and Kilkenny and first of all wonder where they're going to play her, and then who is the best player to pick her up, just given how much she's capable of rotating.
Yeah, and I suppose like that is the question. As somebody who's played against Kilkenny a lot of times, Marie, the big question was where would Anne actually be playing? So you could have a number of game plans for them. And that, look, I think it's a compliment to Anne, in fairness. She's such a talented camogie player that she can play defensively, middle third, or even, I suppose, up in the full forward line, which I think she was started there against Waterford in the first round. I think they had a two-man full forward line. For me, look, I'd have her around the middle third. I'd keep her out in space. I'd let other people do maybe a bit more of the hard work with regard to rucks and whatnot, and I'd try to get the ball to her as much as possible. And I would have her out around the middle third. Would you sacrifice a player to mark her? I think it's a very hard job because she is so, I suppose, intelligent off the ball as she is on it. It's a hard one to track her and to read her. So I don't know if Cork will sacrifice a player. Looking at how they set up against Clare, it looked like Cork were going for maybe three across the middle to try and crowd out that middle third as much as possible. Niamh O'Callaghan was on the programme as corner forward, and I know Niamh, and I've never seen her play corner forward. you know, she went straight out, took Chloe's spot in the centre field for the throw-in, and Chloe went, I think she went right half forward or left half forward, and then came out and drifted out around the middle. So maybe they're doing that with Kilkenny and Galway in mind with regard to, I suppose, how dominant they are in that area.
But because people know that that's what they do, and you know, it's that kind of possession passing game that they play, do you think that Paddy might do something different? Like, he might have an ace up his sleeve because the expectation is that they're going to do what they always do?
Oh, look, it could easily happen, Marie, but I just think seeing how they've been playing over the last number of games, it's been quite interesting because you can see them building a number of course, different ways of playing, whether that's, you know, keeping you know, five in the forward, maybe two inside, building a bit of a T situation, or maybe more of a tighter centre line with regard to space out in the wings. For some people, it looks quite that they only have one way of playing, but just knowing from being in the system previously, he has a number of ways of tweaking it. And I think, obviously, learning a huge amount from, I suppose, what we came up against last year in a semi-final against Galway, I'm sure he'll have a number of slight tweaks that he can do on Saturday if Kilkenny try to stop certain elements of that.
Well, no better man to have a trick up his sleeve, I'll say that. So Tip and Galway, I heard a great line in the Women's Hurling podcast this week. They said, Tip won't worry about Galway, Galway won't worry about Tip, and it'll be class.
I know. Look, you know, compared to, I suppose, we were just talking about Kilkenny and Cork, and, you know, we spent half our time talking about maybe tactics and what this team was going to do to the other team, whereas this is, I suppose, a small bit more unknown with regard to how both teams will go at it on Saturday. And I think, again, a bit like Cork, the quarterfinal for Tipperary, that was a big win against Waterford. Look, I was wrong. I tipped Waterford to come out that day, and Tip proved me wrong, and rightly so. And I think what you saw in that quarterfinal was work rate, and not just from the big names, but I just thought particularly from the offensive lineup, how hard they worked to turn that ball over. I would be concerned. They got six wides alone in the first half. Playing against Galway and just seeing even how well they do with the possession they have, they gotta be getting those over the bar to put the squeeze on Galway.
Yeah, and I think the likes of Sarah Dervin and all that defence there, they're going to be so hard to break down. But when you talk about matchups, and you kind of hope that maybe that Sarah Dervin and Cote Devan might be one that you'll see, because I'd just love to see how that would play out.
Yeah, and look, maybe I couldn't see it myself, just simply because I think Cort, looking at her in the quarterfinal, and she was outstanding.
And I think seeing she drifted away out to the half-forward line. I think at one stage she won a ball in her own half-back line. So, you know, there's no way I can't see Sarah going all the way out that far. And she is, look, she commands the square. So I just don't know, if you're Colin Murray, why would you give her that job of doing it? Now, as a goalkeeper in my day, having caught in front of you, it was never an easy task either. So look, I just was super impressed with her in the quarterfinal. And not just how she played, I suppose, inside the line, but, you know, she tracked her way back and won ball and distributed it and was exceptional on the dead ball as well.
Aisling Maloney, so we haven't seen that much of her in this championship so far. You'd imagine she'd come back in, because for what we did see of her, she lit it up. But would you bring her back in when you think about it onto a winning team?
Yeah, look, in fairness, she made her presence felt, making a championship this year. But look, I don't know. I think if you looked at them in the quarterfinal, I think the other players, Karen Kennedy, Nicola Walsh, Grace O'Brien, they all had an outstanding game. It's a semi-final. Would you go and maybe just throw something into the mix to surprise Galway? I'm not too sure. I think you would just go and see how it go first. But, you know, what a brilliant player to be able to bring in from the sideline if you needed to maybe create a small bit of havoc. Physically, she's very commanding. So, look, I don't know. Would you start her from the start? I'd definitely have her there, and I would definitely bring her on at some stage.
Yeah, well, speaking of benches, Galway do have an impressive bench themselves.
Yeah, they do, and I just think maybe it's one area in particular that Galway will have over Tipperary. And, you know, you saw it the last day. You've got, you know, McGrath on the bench, which would probably be on any starting first 15, Marie, if you're honest about it. And, you know, that in itself, I think, will be the bit that, in particular because we now play in quarters, and looking at, I suppose, Tipperary's last quarter, they became very defensive. And let Waterford kind of come at them a small bit, and maybe that was they just wanted to get over the finishing line. But that last quarter, you'll see the bench from Galway, I suppose, really putting the squeeze on Tipperary. I hope it's a real competitive game, and as you say, both teams just go at it.
So tell me then, who is going to be in the All-Ireland final?
No pressure.
I know, yeah. I only got a 50% return the last day. Look, the first game, Cork and Kilkenny. Maybe it's because I'm probably not out of the scene for that long. I would be going for Cork. I just think with the run-up they've had to the semi-final, I think it's been really good for them. They've constantly brought on three or four subs, I think, as well. So, you know, going back to the bench, I just think they'll have one or two players to bring on. And I still think Katie Power is a big loss for Kilkenny. So, look, I'm going to go with Cork. I'll stay local, as they say, and I'll go with Cork on. I know, yeah, I can go home. For that, and then look, Galway and Tip, and you know, I'm more than happy for Tip to prove me wrong like they did in the quarter final. But I would look, I think it's very hard to look past Galway for a Saturday, and I think, look, they're all Ireland champions for a reason, and I just think they'll have a little bit more, in particularly, I suppose, in the bench to get them over the finishing line on Saturday.
Okay, Aoife, well, we'll see what happens, see if you're going to be right this time. We're going to take a quick break and then we're back with ladies football.
With Green Farm, healthy snacking made easy. With Green Farm's high protein on the go range, available in selected Tesco, Super Value, and convenience stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We do have a ladies' football semi-final down for decision as well, with Armagh and Dublin facing off. And to chat us through that, we are joined by Nadine Doherty. Nadine, which team would you prefer to be? The one like Armagh heading in with loads of momentum, or Dublin, who are a little bit more, I suppose, under the radar?
I think I'd rather be Dublin and have three All-Ireland, something like that, to be honest, Marie.
I should have mentioned that as well.
I think I'd take that one and be under the radar for sure. Look, as you said, there's no pressure on Armagh. There's the prize package of this year's championship. And yeah, surprisingly, they're coming up against the Dublin team who nobody is really talking about. Huge attacking threats from both sides. And both teams have shown the most consistency, really, thus far in the championship. And they both deserve to be there, for sure.
Well, you have to wonder then, how are Armagh going to cope with all of those big name players that we've seen so often do the business now for Dublin? We can see at one end of the pitch, they're well able to score. We've mentioned Amy Macken before, so we know what she's capable of. We know what Kelly Mallon is. But then you go looking at the Dublin side and, you know, the Lindsay Davies, Sinead Hearns, the Cara Rose, it's hard really to see how they're going to contain so many of those. Throw in Noelle Healy as well.
Yeah, you know, as we said, like, Armagh's strength is in that forward line. And what they've been doing so far in the Championship, really, they've backed that attacking unit. You know, they haven't really worried too much about conceding high scores because they've trusted the girls up front that they'll rack up the scores and get them over the line. Look, Dublin, that defensive system, they're going to have been focusing on that Armagh unit for the last couple of weeks. I'd imagine, you know, Mick Bohan, he's not going to be as naive as Neil Ware, leaving that full back line exposed. I think they'd really try and hit Armagh early out the field, disrupt that supply going in. And they always, Dublin always seem to have that holding player. They rotate the role. They're so good at doing it. They provide the cover, and then they also just give that platform to launch the counter attack. And just that defensive system, it starts at the opposition 45. As each line is broken, you just see that Dublin line of defence filter back, more players filter in. And, you know, if Armagh don't move that ball quickly in the middle third, they could find themselves in front of a blue wall of 10 to 12 blue shirts. So they will find that difficult.
In a word, call it for us, Nadine.
Listen, it's 2020, Marie.
And true.
After the carry-on that went on at the weekend there with Cavan and Pip, look, there might be another performance of a lifetime from Armagh. I think they need that, but it's really hard to look past the Dubs.
That's for sure. Nadine, thanks so much for joining us. Donegal, are we a competition winner?
We do, and they're from Tipperary. It's all going Tip's way at the moment. It's Linda Grogan, who runs 70 miles a week. And there's a good reason you're hungry, Linda, so we thought it was a good idea to give you this incredible Green Farm goodies bag, which is jam-packed, 100% natural, high in protein and brilliant range of brilliant snacks. So enjoy that.
Donegal, as a professional athlete, how many miles a week would you have run?
Ooh, 6K was... Oh, sorry, 20K was in a training week, and then a match was 6. So
that's
probably
right,
26,
yeah.
Not even close.
Well, I mean, it's more than I thought you'd have run.
But then I'd probably eat Linda for a snack.
Yeah, true.
Okay, that's it from all of us. A massive thank you to Laura Lee and Andrew. We're back tomorrow at 6. The awesome Tara Shorts up next.